Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett, but my Tibetan name is Dorje Lama Bumpo, or so I was called during those 20 years I spent in the Himalayas working on the finer points of tantric meditation. That was just after the decade I spent learning to hunt elk barehanded with the Ojibwa in Canada. There I was known as Dances with Baloney. The point is, it's hard to become part of another culture, and harder still to become good at anything esoteric inside that culture. Yet, for some reason, it's the esoteric stuff that appeals to the outsider. Tantric meditation, for instance, seems quintessentially Tibetan to us, even though rather few Tibetans know anything about it. Likewise, I imagine that the standard Ojibwa technique nowadays for bringing down an elk depends upon a gun and a snowmobile and a couple of six-packs. But you and I would never want to spend a decade learning that, would we? Producer Mary Beth Kirshner has been observing Americans in Japan, a certain kind of Americans who are there not just to learn the language or the manners. They want to master the essence of Japanese-ness, those esoteric arts which are perhaps more Japanese than the Japanese themselves. Our show is called American Yokozuna.
It's 6 a.m. in Tokyo on a late fall morning. Life here has already started to stir. Shopkeepers gently sweeping leaves from their doorsteps. Launderers pressing clothes with quiet bursts of steam. A gentle stream of traffic. These are the only sounds to be heard on the back roads of the city at dawn, until I turn down a side street en route to my final destination. I'm looking for some Americans and have been led to an unlikely location to find them, a sumo wrestling practice. The wrestlers already look exhausted as I caught my first glimpse of their push-ups and stretches. I know from having read about their training schedule, they've been at it for hours. In traditional sumo dress, what's most easily described as giant diapers, with their long hair pulled up into a knot at the top of their heads, these redwoods of men, 400, 500, up to 600 pounds each, slam into each other with a force that almost knocks the wind out of me watching on the sidelines. This exercise pits a young wrestler against one of his senior teammates, in which the novice is taunted over and over again to charge his opponent and push him out of the ring. Until he's successful, the exercise continues relentlessly. You can hear the exhaustion. Have you ever known that quality of breathing where you can hardly control the inhales and exhales, where each breath is so rough and raw that it seems as though the body is pleading, begging to stop? Yet their trainer won't let them quit. He's an American from Hawaii, the first foreigner to enter sumo wrestling in Japan 30 years ago, named Jesse Takamiyama. As a manager, he's now taken Japanese citizenship and the name Azumazeki Oyakata.
Because I remember coming here in 64, my goal that I wanted to become a sumo wrestler.
He's speaking English, yet I feel the urge to translate. Wrestling has taken its toll on his voice. He says that when he came to Tokyo in 1964 wanting to be a sumo wrestler, he went through immense hardship. His greatest accomplishment was winning one major tournament, after which he received a call from President Nixon.
I was so thrilled about that.
Azumazeki is now referred to as the Pathfinder, paving the way for other Hawaiians and foreigners to enter the sport. His pride and joy is a young Hawaiian, Chad Rowan, now Akebono, who's the only foreigner ever to be named Yokozuna, or Grand Champion.
Most of us don't come from rich families, but a majority of us that come here from Hawaii, if we don't want to do it for ourselves, we do it for our family. We're hungry, have a lot of fighting spirit. We come here knowing that we got to work.
Akebono sped through the ranks in 5 years to become Grand Champion, but not without a struggle. He was recruited for sumo while a high school basketball star in Hawaii. Actually, he and his older brother, who also played basketball, were brought to Japan at the same time as sumo hopefuls. Not long after, his brother dropped out, yet Akebono stayed, speaking no Japanese, without family or friends, only a grueling training schedule. He admitted later that there were many nights during those early days when he cried himself to sleep. Sumo is a Spartan existence, one which most Japanese would have difficulty enduring, let alone a foreigner. They live in stables. Yes, they call them stables, where each day begins at 4:30 a.m. for several hours of brutal workouts, after which young wrestlers are expected to carry out menial tasks like wiping the sweaty bodies of the senior wrestlers, preparing meals, attending to the stable master with his bath. It's a harsh list of chores, which continues until 10 at night, 7 days a week. Some say it's like a monastery, with a boot camp lifestyle going on inside. Sumo has a 1,300-year history where most of the ancient rites and rituals are still preserved. It's a part of Japan's cultural heritage, and as such, the grand champion is expected to uphold the traditions of the sport 24 hours a day. Akebono has been the focus of considerable controversy in the sumo world as the first foreigner and currently the only person of grand champion status. The pressure on this Yokozuna is considerable.
That's why I try to explain it like baseball players. They go to the park, they play practice baseball.
Do you hear that? That's wind noise hitting my microphone, caused by a young wrestler who was fanning Akebono with a giant palm during our interview. No, I'm not kidding.
Excuse me, Akebono. With a fan, sometimes I get wind, so if he were slower with the fan, it would be great. Sorry. Go on, Nessai.
Only the Yokozuna gets such pampered treatment. Akebono was trying to compare his position to that of a baseball star in the U.S. who could walk off the playing field at the end of a game and lead a life of his own. In sumo, as the grand champion, he has little to no privacy. His schedule is carefully monitored by the Japanese Sumo Association, whose interest is to maintain the dignity of the position at all times. It's as though Chad Rowan, the high school basketball star, has been completely transformed.
I think if I was to get up one morning and somebody would just call me by my first name and not Yokozuna, and I don't think I'll be able to handle
it. Really? So nobody calls you Chad anymore?
No.
No? Not even your mother?
Oh, she calls me. It's only her. But she's probably the only person.
So if I were to ask you to guess 5 or 10 years from now what you would be doing, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, you wouldn't have had any idea you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No.
Do you have any idea?
Well, you know one thing, when I was a little child, I used to tell everybody I was going to be rich and famous. I used to tell everybody, I'm going to be famous one day, and you guys going, oh, be sorry.
You were right.
There are a few other Hawaiians who have come to Japan for sumo who've not achieved the celebrity status of Akebono, yet who were just as intriguing. There was one wrestler at the stable who told me he's now in his 7th year of sumo in Japan. I'd noticed him earlier that morning. He'd been given the task of wiping the sweat off Akebono during practice. I asked him why. After years of training, with all due respect, it was clear he was never going to become a champion. Good question, he laughed and thought for a moment. It's better than my life back home, even what you saw me doing this morning. This is more exciting, I guess. These sumo wrestlers caught in this odd world of ancient rituals aren't all that different from anyone else who's left home in search of a better or different life, a new or more exciting career. Or are they? This commitment seemed to demand more immersion than most Americans might be willing to tolerate, Sure, there are plenty of American bankers, consultants, entrepreneurs, students, or English teachers on temporary assignments in Japan. These people seem to be of a completely different breed. I was fascinated by the handful of Americans in Japan who had ventured deeply into the traditional culture, where frankly most Japanese would no longer go, not just sumo wrestling, but to become Buddhist monks, masters of kabuki theater, and traditional music. These are extremely rare choices, even for a Japanese. It came as a surprise to me to learn that the average cultured Japanese has little exposure to or interest in the traditional arts. Since the end of World War II, most Japanese are more likely to have studied Impressionist art, classical music, jazz, or read novels translated from English than to go to the kabuki theater or to listen to traditional music. These American practitioners of the arts in traditional Japan seemed admirably to me the antithesis of the ugly American. They'd mastered the language, devoted a large piece of their lives to studying another culture. Most of them had no intention of ever coming back to the United States, yet oddly, the few that I met always seemed at the periphery of this new culture which they'd adopted.
There's a period of, those first several years when you feel maybe a child, you're walking in front of your house and a child says, "Gaijin," you know, foreigner, and looks at you. And particularly in the first several years, I think it bothered me a lot more.
Gaijin, the Japanese term for foreigner, is a key expression to understanding the experience of being non-Japanese in Japan. Even Rick Emmert, who has lived in Japan for 20 years and is a highly respected scholar of Japanese theater, still hears it on the street. It applies to anyone of any race who is non-Japanese. A foreign face is still rare in most of Japan. Non-Japanese comprise less than 1% of the population. And as a foreigner, you simply cannot walk down the street or ride the subway without attracting an occasional glance or sometimes the whispered acknowledgement, "Gaijin." I'll never forget being stopped by complete strangers in rural Japan to pose for photos because of the novelty still of seeing a foreigner.
At first, it's sort of shocking, but that's going to exist forever. If I worried about that, I wouldn't be able to take it. I've known some foreigners who've lived in Japan for a long time who've really been upset by that. And it's a comment that people talk about we've been talking about for 20 years, ever since I've been here. You know, Japanese aren't open or aren't willing to see people just as other people, as people. Instead, they sort of have an us against them, sort of. You have the Japanese versus Gaijin, and all Gaijin become, you know, the outsider, and the insider are the Japanese. And yeah, I guess maybe there's somewhere along the line that I probably wanted to become Japanese, but I think it's a futile endeavor. Even if I changed my name and I did everything and took out Japanese citizenship or something, I wouldn't become, people would still say Gaijin to me. I can't change my looks. I think it's probably a stage that foreigners in Japan have to get over.
Rick Emmert has chosen a profession in the traditional world of Japan, where unlike Akebono, he will never reach the acclaim of a Yokozuna. Akebono has literally and figuratively pushed his way to the top. There's no such path in the traditional arts. An artist practically has to be born into a family in the traditional arts to be accepted within the profession. Emmert has devoted 4 times as much time as Akebono to his craft in Japan, has toured internationally as a performer and lecturer, has mastered all of the instruments, started his own theater troupe, yet to a degree he sits outside of his field. He's considered an amateur, not a professional. He is not permitted to be a member of the No Association. Yet he's actually come to think of his position as an advantage. No, spelled N-O-H, is the classical stage art of Japan, developed from a variety of sacred rituals and festival entertainment, with a history which goes back 6 centuries.
Because I talk to groups in Japanese or I talk to groups in English, I become an important link between the No Association and the outside world. And because of the fact that I'm a foreigner doing that, I have this sort of special position with, because I can introduce things in English to the outside world about No. But then because I'm also a foreigner who often does this in Japanese, it brings in people, Japanese, who are not at all versed or knowledgeable at all of No. And perhaps my perspective is one that Japanese who are outside of the tradition might relate to a little bit more.
4 steps. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then shift to the right.
Emmert teaches No to many American college students in Japan. That's the age at which he first became enchanted with No theater, while a college student from Indiana on an exchange program.
Yo-mo-tsuki-ji, and it's some dynamic stuff, so it's very strict. Yo-mo-tsuki-ji.
Yo-mo-tsuki-ji.
Okay, I'll sing it.
I was warned by friends before seeing No for the first time that it was extremely boring, moving at a pace that could be called glacial speed. Even Emmert laughingly told me of numerous would-be authorities who'd facetiously suggested that No theater means no movement, no drama, and no music.
I thought of it less as a 600-year-old tradition than as a new avant-garde, just an amazing work, which is more contemporary. I would go to plays and just watch and sort of be mesmerized and hypnotized by the whole thing.
When we talk about theater, we usually think about realistic theater. Therefore, what happens, I think, is that you forget that No is not just theater, but it's music theater, it's dance theater, it's poetic theater, and it's not realistic theater. There are various ways that you can artistically approach No, which have nothing to do with the story. We haven't even gotten to the story. For that reason, the people who do like No like it for a number of... I mean, there are some people who like it for are very interested in the music. That was my approach. My approach, perhaps that's the rarest in some ways. My approach was very much through the music.
As I listen to Emmert's beautiful voice singing No, I'm reminded of his telling me once of his aspirations before coming to Japan as a young college student to become an opera singer or a politician. I wanted him to explain how his life had strayed so far from those more standard American dreams.
It hasn't been planned at all. It's a result of just sort of pretty much following my heart. To say there's any one thing that just really grasped me, I don't think that's what it is. I think there have just been enough little things that sort of keep on pulling you in. It's like a magnet. I would be strong enough to resist it. But why resist it if you enjoy it? I think I've just been slowly drawn in. Now I'm doing so many things with it that if I stopped doing everything with No, I'd be crazy. The craziest thing I could do. What could I do? No, it's not that easy.
easy it's not getting in or out.
At one point, I was ready to give it up and just forget it, because it wasn't encouraged, and also the traditional music scene here is just so difficult to get into. People are not encouraging, are not accepting. There was no form for me to follow, nor no path for me to follow. I had to make it myself.
Christopher Blaisdell's story is not much different from Rick Emmert's. He too has lived in Japan for over 20 years and has had to create his own niche in the traditional music world of Japan. As a master of the shakuhachi flute, he lectures to visitors, performs with other foreigners, tours internationally. Blaisdell came to Japan, like Emmert, at a pivotal age while a college student. But Blaisdell came from a world away, the Texas Panhandle. Tokyo was the first city he'd ever lived in.
And I was excited about living in a city, finally, after all these years, after all, what, 20 years. And so I wanted this hustle and bustle. I wanted this proximity of people. I liked having people around. I grew up on a ranch outside of the small town in Texas, and so it was always pretty much alone. Very often after school, just come home and do nothing or do chores on the ranch, but this was always alone. So I already had a feeling of solitude within me, which I liked and always kept. And I always had a feeling of space within me, I think, because the spaces in Texas, as you know, are in the Panhandle, are just immense. There's nothing but space. So a lot of people ask me, when they realize I'm from Texas, they ask me, well, don't you miss the space, or don't you abhor the crowding in Tokyo? Of course, crowding and lack of space is not pleasant, but I think it's because I had that growing up. I had the space inside me.
City of 10 million was certainly a switch from life on a ranch. Clearly, that was part of the appeal. More than the sense of reinventing your life, which I'd assumed was the motivation with the sumo wrestlers who'd left basketball, or in Rick Emmert's switch from opera to no, Blaisdell had an even more startling explanation.
I started with a blank slate, but I've sort of colored it and filled it up with things, ideas and colors and sounds and tones and such. And I thought at one point it's always wonderful to have a blank slate, but I realize as you get older the things accumulate and you create your own color, you create your own life. So no, it's not blank anymore.
Saying that he came to Japan with a blank slate was hard for me to believe. Even as a young college student, how could you see your identity as a blank slate?
Coming from West Texas, where white men have only been around for 100 years, my grandfather was one of the settlers in the Panhandle of Texas. I didn't have a feeling of cultural identity. So when I came to Japan, I realized that I yearned, for one sense, I yearned for a cultural identity. But then I realized that if I weren't in the position I was in, I couldn't be able to assimilate another culture, because I'd be too busy trying to deal with my own identity, like so many young black Americans, young Asian Americans, not necessarily young, but Hispanic Americans. Everybody has to deal with their culture, or accept it or deny it or do something with it. I was blank for both good and bad. So I could come here and sort of accept a culture, somebody else's culture, but yet just take the parts I liked. And because I wasn't born in it, and I didn't feel attached to it. If I didn't like it, I'd just say, no, I don't like this part. If I liked it, I'd say, yes, I like it, regardless of its connotations. And I thought many times that this is a very American way to do things.
Perhaps the piecemeal culture which Blaisdell describes is a better way of characterizing what many of these Americans had done in creating such unusual lives so far from home. Selecting those elements that were most appealing, ignoring those that didn't quite fit, building an identity that was their own, finding a culture within the culture. That wasn't such a foreign concept. Perhaps that's how most of us find fulfillment in life, regardless of where or how we live. We extract those elements which resonate most strongly with us, which then lead us to be opera singers, sumo wrestlers, or radio producers, and help us clarify who we are.
Now that's a difficult question. I would say a musician. Well, I have to say American because that's what my passport says. And I have to say white because that's what my skin color is, Caucasian. Actually, I like the word Caucasian because within Caucasian, the word Asian is already there. So I like that word. I think that's not just by incident. I think there's some design to that word that suggests that we all have a bit of Asia in us.
American Yokozuna was produced by Mary Beth Kirchner, associate producer Molly Murphy, special thanks to George Kochi and the Asian Cultural Council. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Today's program is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Soundprint Program Fund, and with support from the Hosa Bunka Foundation. Additional support is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation. Write us with your ideas and comments. Write Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50. To order a cassette with a credit card, call us at 202-885-1285. That's 202-885-1285. Our email address is soundprint@american.edu. Join us next week on Soundprint for a trip to an island off the coast of Yugoslavia.
Yeah. It's beautiful old trees down this path. What you're looking at here to the right, these are olive trees.
When you were a kid, did your father tell you about this area?
Told me all about it. Told me about this island. I knew this island before I knew my own neighborhood. He told me all about it. Where he was born, how he grew up, about all of these flagstones that make up the walls that you look at. They call ploche. And he would say how they were bloody from the work that went on around them.
He was 16 when he left here, but he probably did that kind of work,
oh,
too.
Oh, yes, very much so. You start at a young age, and when you're the oldest, you start first.
The old country is gone. Next week. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria De Freitas, Studio Engineer Robin Wise, Production Assistant Francesca Raymond. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massett. This is NPR. National Public Radio.